On August 11th, 1921, in Birmingham, Alabama, a Methodist minister shot and killed a Catholic priest in broad daylight in front of a crowd of witnesses. The resulting murder trial has virtually disappeared from historical memory. It was a sensation at the time because it featured so many elements of intolerance, including Southern racism, anti-Catholicism, and xenophobia. This is the story of the murder of Father John Coyle. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. Oh.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. One of the most shocking murders in the history of Birmingham, Alabama, happened on August the 11th of 1921. Father John Coyle, a Catholic priest, was murdered in cold blood in front of his rectory near the church he loved. A Methodist minister turned himself into police, admitting he murdered the priest. But prejudice and hatred in the American South would lead to the minister getting away with murder. Father James Edwin Coyle was a native of Ireland who had been ordained in Rome on May 30th of 1896 when he was 23 years old. Later that year, he was dispatched to Alabama to begin his priesthood. He served faithfully in what was then the Diocese of Mobile, Alabama for 8 years, first in parish missions, then as an instructor and rector of the Institute for Boys. In 1904, Father Coyle was appointed pastor of the large congregation of St. Paul's Catholic Church in Birmingham, Alabama, the youngest city in the state, but the largest, with over 300,000 people living in the city limits at the time. Father Coyle was well received and loved by the congregation and many members of the community. In May of 1904, a Birmingham newspaper printed a short article about Father John Coyle that speaks to how well he was liked by people who met him. It's important to know, for the sake of the story of Father Coyle's life and the obstacles he would face years later, that this account is from a Protestant man who had befriended Father Coyle and wanted to share his thoughts on the man serving the community at St. Paul's. The article read in parts, "There goes one of the simplest, most natural, and most scholarly men that have ever preached the gospel in this town. Father Coyle is a graduate of university, but a poor fellow, unlearned like me, can talk with him all afternoon and never even suspect that he is conversing with a superior person. His clear, wide-open, and wide-apart blue eyes, his firm chin, high and noble brow, and the whole contour of his face and head invite confidence, affection, and admiration. Divest him out of his clerical dress, and you would pick him out in any company as clear-headed, clean-hearted fellow who'd go with you on a 10-mile walk in the country with a good cigar and a better story at the end of the jaunt." Father Coyle would serve at St. Paul's for 17 years. During the last few years of his service in Birmingham, there were big shifts in the city. The city was an iron and steelmaking center of the United States, and workers were in high demand, along with the coal industry that was on the rise by the early 1920s. Huge numbers of immigrants from South and Eastern Europe were coming to America and moving to the South to fill the jobs that were open, fueling opportunity for them and their families. But they faced obstacles. Foreigners made native Alabamians uncomfortable for two main reasons. First, they were suspicious of new immigrant groups who may not respect white hierarchy in the United States. The racial order in Birmingham and across the country was clear. Whites were supreme at the time, and that extended to all parts of life: business, churches, schools, hotels, and restaurants. Second, Greeks, Italians, and Lebanese came in large numbers, and they were speaking foreign languages, and Alabamians began to question the allegiance of foreigners to the United States. Keep in mind, World War I had ended a few years earlier in 1918, and people in America were suspicious of many people who spoke foreign, unfamiliar languages. They were quite simply afraid of the unknown and afraid of anyone who was different. And this led to a rise in xenophobia in Alabama. And for anyone who doesn't immediately know what that means, xenophobia is this intense dislike or fear of people from other countries. It's an irrational dislike of people from other countries. And that irrational dislike and irrational fear extended to religions as well. Specifically in Alabama in the early 1920s, that fear and dislike was extended to Catholics. Catholics were said to never be able to be patriots because they owed their allegiance to a foreign leader, to the Pope. And Catholics were disfavored across the South because of the Catholic Church's openness to blacks and the Catholic Church's openness to educating black people, welcoming black children into their schools. And the laws of the day backed up that xenophobia and racism that was rampant at the time. The law was used to support what was believed to be the right racial relationships and the right religions of the day. There were laws in place to prevent interracial marriage. This extended to all races, not just preventing a black person from marrying a white person. If an interracial couple tried to get a marriage license, they were denied, and no pastor of any church was to marry a mixed race couple. And there were laws in place in Alabama at the time that made it possible to inspect Catholic buildings for ammunitions and for people who may be held against their will inside Catholic churches, convents, monasteries, rectories, even Catholic-owned hospitals. This was done in part after false stories were spread that Catholics were holding Protestants against their will in an effort to convert them to Catholicism. And as for the search for ammunitions in these Catholic-owned buildings, well, that was because of false stories that were circulating across America that Catholics were waiting for the day that their leader, remember their foreign leader, the Pope, had called on his foot soldiers to stockpile ammunitions so that when the day came, he would call upon his people to lead a revolution against Protestants and America's leaders. State legislators passed these laws that the buildings could be searched with no warrant, and there was a very specific part of the law that said that anyone who warned a Catholic of an impending inspection could be arrested and prosecuted. This was the climate that existed for Catholics in the South at the time. Sharon Davies is the author of Rising Road, a true tale of love, race, and religion in America. And in her book, she points out that with this attitude in the South, a part of the historical truth of the Ku Klux Klan in America has often been ignored. That truth that we haven't paid enough attention to was the religious aspect of the Ku Klux Klan that had been revived and was on the rise in the 1920s. The original Ku Klux Klan, or KKK as they're commonly known, they were formed after the Civil War by former Confederates who still held on to their idea of white supremacy. The Klan worked together to intimidate people of color through violent acts and threats of violence. By the late 1870s, federal laws passed to prosecute the KKK, and their power decreased and seemed to fade away. That was until 1915, when the movie The Birth of a Nation was released. It was a box office hit, and this movie that crowds were rushing to see glorified the Ku Klux Klan. And that glorification of the Klan inspired a man named William Simmons of Harpersville, Alabama, to announce that the Klan was alive again, reborn thanks to the birth of a nation. Simmons announced the KKK was back with a large cross burning on Stone Mountain outside of Atlanta, Georgia. The KKK rebranded themselves as an organization that was defending the United States and standing up for America and against all foreigners, blacks, Jews, and Catholics. And the rebranding worked. People bought into their message of hate. This revived Klan was so popular, using the fear of immigrants and the fear of Catholics and Jews to attract leaders in communities, including clergy members, to join the KKK. Imagine your Father Coyle heading up a large Catholic church in Birmingham, Alabama, and this is the atmosphere surrounding you. A growing anti-Catholic persecution that was organized and promoted by the KKK. You had a choice. Ignore it, remain silent, hope things will change, or stand up to the Klan and try to defend your religion and defend immigrants and defend anyone who was different. Father Coyle did not remain silent. He stood up to members of the KKK who were traveling around Birmingham, burning churches, carrying out acts of violence, and his defense of immigrants and people of all faiths would ultimately cost him his life. One way Father Coyle was able to stand up to the Ku Klux Klan and the atmosphere of xenophobia in Birmingham was with the help of the press. At the time, regional tabloids would often feature letters to the editor that spoke against Catholics in the city of Birmingham. But Father Coyle was an incredible writer, and he wrote letters to the editor of the newspapers at the time that were published. In his letters, he defended his faith and defended immigrants who were being targeted with violence and hatred. And Father Coyle would speak to what he referred to as the ignorant suppositions of bigots. And he knew that after his letters were published in a paper, a new wave of attacks and death threats would flow in against Catholics and specifically against Father Coyle. When a Catholic church and school were burned down in Pratt City near Birmingham, federal authorities gave Father Coyle information that forced him to hire armed guards to protect his church and his rectory. To say Father Coyle was despised by those who were anti-Catholic and pro-KKK is an understatement. But there was one man in Birmingham whose hate for Father Coyle was fueled not only by his relationship with the KKK and his own xenophobia. In the mind of this man, Father Coyle was a threat to his family. The man was a Methodist minister named Edwin Stevenson. The minister lived with his wife and their only child, Ruth. He was ordained but never had an official pastorate. He would make money for his family by going to the county courthouse in Birmingham and telling couples he could marry them in the hallways of the courthouse if they paid him on the spot. He became known as the marrying man. Reverend Stevenson was very anti-Catholic. He was a Klansman, and he considered it his worst nightmare when he learned that his daughter Ruth expressed an interest in Catholicism. You see, when Ruth was about 12 years old, Stevenson discovered her talking to Father Coyle about the Catholic Church. She was told to stop asking questions, and Ruth would later tell friends her punishment for talking to Father Coyle that day was severe. But Ruth grew into one of the greatest threats of a Southern father in the 1920s. She grew into an independent woman with an independent spirit. She knew what she wanted and pursued what she wanted. As the years passed, Ruth continued to ask questions and seek answers from people who were Catholic. Ruth turned 18 on August the 29th of 1920 and started attending Catholic classes at Our Lady of Sorrows in Birmingham. By the following spring, she had been baptized into the Catholic Church. When Edwin Stevenson learned what Ruth had done, he told her that even if she was 18, the law did not matter. He tried to convince Ruth that she didn't have the freedom to convert. And when she defended herself and her actions, Reverend Stevenson threatened to kill her. Ruth left home to stay with friends on the south side of Birmingham. She had planned to stay until her father's anger passed, but her father called in the Birmingham police chief, who happened to be a fellow member of the KKK. Stevenson told the police chief that Ruth had been kidnapped by a Catholic family. The chief ordered police to the home where Ruth was staying and supervised her exit and return to her father's home because he was her legal guardian and had the power to take her back. Once Ruth was home with her father, Edwin Stevenson used violence to try to convince Ruth that she couldn't make her own choice. The Reverend nailed the windows of Ruth's bedroom shut, tied her to the bed, and beat her with a leather razor strap. Ruth's mother was a part of it, too. She stuck a rag in Ruth's mouth to muffle the screams. This continued until Ruth agreed to give up her desire to be Catholic. But her resolution would not last long. Ruth Stevenson knew that once she turned 21, the law would recognize her as an adult. Her choices would be her own. But Ruth knew that her father would not relinquish his control over her once she reached that age. Ruth knew she had to take the only path that could secure legal emancipation from her parents. She needed to become a married woman. She thought of Pedro Guzman, a man from Puerto Rico who had worked in her family's home when Ruth was about 13 years old. He had stayed in the home when he was working as a wallpaper hanger. Pedro was 24 years older than Ruth, although many people have described him and written about Pedro saying he didn't look his age. He connected with Ruth and proposed to her when she was 13. Of course, nothing happened at the time, but they stayed in touch over the years. And in July of 1921, Ruth decided to write a letter to Pedro to let him know that she was ready to accept his marriage proposal. And Pedro was all in. Ruth and Pedro knew the Stevensons wouldn't approve of Ruth's marriage to an older man from Puerto Rico who was also Catholic, so they hatched a plan. According to Courtney Hayden, the author of Murder in the Cathedral that appeared in a Birmingham newspaper in 2014, Ruth and Pedro both worked in downtown Birmingham. They agreed to sneak away from their jobs during their lunch hour, take a streetcar to nearby Bessemer, Alabama, get a license at a courthouse there, and then walk to a nearby Catholic church where they would be married. They decided their wedding day would be August the 11th of 1921. All was going to plan until they reached the Catholic church in Bessemer. They found there was no priest at the church at that time that could marry them. So Ruth and Pedro decided on a risky plan B. They returned to Birmingham to see if Father Coyle would be available to marry them at St. Paul's. This was risky because St. Paul's was near the courthouse where Edwin Stevenson was known as the marrying parson. There was a chance he could see them as they walked by, but Ruth and Pedro made it safely to St. Paul's where they met with Father Coyle. He checked their marriage license and then got his sister and another priest to serve as witnesses to the marriage. According to a report days later in the Birmingham Age Herald, once Father Coyle married them, he told Ruth and Pedro that the right thing to do would be to notify her parents that she was married. Ruth did try to call her parents, but they weren't at home. They had learned that Ruth hadn't returned to work after her lunch break, and by the time she called home, Edwin Stevenson was already out in the summer heat, walking to a police station and then to the sheriff's department to demand they search for his now missing daughter. As Edwin walked the streets of Birmingham looking for his daughter, Ruth made that call home. And when the only person who answered was her cousin, Ruth left a message. "I married a Catholic boy." Ruth couldn't have known it at the time, but her fateful message was a death sentence for Father John Coyle. A little over an hour after Father Coyle married the couple, the priest was sitting on the porch at his church rectory. He would do this most nights after supper, sit on his porch swing and read or reflect on the day. On this night, around 6:30, he was reading his prayer book when Edwin Stevenson walked onto the porch. He had brought a loaded gun with him. Stevenson shot 3 bullets from that gun, and one pierced the left temple of 48-year-old Father John Coyle, who would be declared dead within an hour of that final shot. Edwin Stevenson calmly left Father Coyle's home and walked to the courthouse to surrender himself to police. And as he asked to be locked up, he told police, "It's all right, gentlemen. I know what I'm doing." Father Coyle's murder left not only his church, but the city in shock. The father's funeral 4 days after his murder was the largest in the history of Alabama, to only be exceeded many years later by the death of Coach Bear Bryant, the legendary football coach. Priests, bishops, and mourners from all over the state and even the country came to the funeral of Father Coyle. St. Paul's holds over 1,000 people and was packed with mourners lining the street. One of those mourners lining the street that day was a grief-stricken Ruth Guzman. Someone inside the church on the day of the funeral noted that the voice of the bishop faltered several times during the prayer, and it was even necessary for him to stop to compose himself sufficiently to proceed. The murder of Father Coyle left people in shock in Birmingham, but as his grandnephew, the country and western singer Brendan Shine, would later reveal, the events were virtually unknown in Brendan Shine's family. Father Coyle's mother, who died just a few years later in 1924, was never informed of her son's death. His sister, Marcella, who had lived in Birmingham, later returned to Ireland. It would seem the shock of her brother's death may have led her to never talk of what happened to him in America. The reality of the hate and the prejudice that led to the murder was unbelievable to many. The only thing worse than the father's murder was the trial of the man who had confessed to killing Father Coyle. Edwin Stevenson had turned himself in to police and confessed to the murder of Father John Coyle. The murder had happened in front of a large crowd of witnesses who were walking along 3rd Avenue. This was a very busy street in downtown Birmingham. They heard the shots. Witnesses saw Stevenson walk off the porch and back onto the street. There was never a question as to who caused the death of Father Coyle. At first, Stevenson told police he shot the father in self-defense, saying they had gotten into a fight once he heard from Coyle that his daughter had been married to Guzman. Stevenson claimed he shouted at Coyle. Coyle became angry and pushed him back and knocked him down. Stevenson then took a loaded gun he happened to have on his person and shot at Coyle to save himself. That's a hard claim to make due to witnesses not hearing an argument and no sign of any disturbance or any argument on the porch. Remember, Father Coyle had been reading papers and they were still in a neat stack on his porch near where he had died. And there were no powder burn marks on Father Coyle, which made it seem Coyle had no chance to defend himself or fight with Stevenson. And the trajectory of bullets didn't match Stevenson's story. The trajectory was arched downward, not upward. If Stevenson had been knocked down and was on his knees with Father Coyle attacking him, as he claimed, the trajectory would have been upward towards Father Coyle. Stevenson's defense team was organized and funded by the Ku Klux Klan. They wanted to make their presence known to all parties, raising money to pay for a top legal defense team, three of which were Klan members. The man who would head up the team was Hugo Black, who would later become a Supreme Court justice in the 1930s. Black was not a member of the KKK at the time of the trial, but he would be within years. When Hugo Black took on the case, Stevenson's defense was changed from self-defense to temporary insanity. The prosecutor in the case was Joe Tate. He faced obstacles from the start, with the grand jury being slow to even return an indictment. It took 2 months before they indicted Stevenson for second-degree murder, not first. That showed Tate that it was going to be a tough road to try to convict Edwin Stevenson. On October 17th of 1921, the trial that had captured the attention of the entire country began in a very crowded Jefferson County courthouse, with a jury of mostly Klansmen taking their place in the courtroom. Many of the witnesses called by Prosecutor Tate were Catholic, and the defense team immediately questioned their credibility. And that's when Tate recognized that the defense team was going to put the Catholic Church on trial by suggesting that Edwin Stevenson and his wife had been tortured for years by the Catholic Church's attempt to steal their daughter away from the Methodist Church, that the Stevenson family were the victims of the Catholic Church and the victims of Father Coyle. And race was an issue as well. The defense questioned Pedro's true race and suggested Pedro was a descendant of a Black person. Defense attorney Hugo Black went so far as to arrange the lights in the courtroom so the darkness of Guzman's complexion would be accentuated. Pedro Guzman had been living as a white man, accepted by the city of Birmingham. Edwin Stevenson had even cut Pedro's hair back when Edwin was a barber for a short time, which would not have happened had Stevenson even suspected Pedro was a Black man. At the time, a white man wouldn't cut a Black man's hair in the South. As one reporter has said of Hugo Black's actions in the court that day, by invoking the basest taboo of Jim Crow's South, race mixing, Hugo Black sought to suggest that Father Coyle's enabling of depravity might well have driven his client past rational response to the commission of murder. As to Ruth, Ruth did not testify during the trial. Reporters did not portray Ruth in a kind way. Ruth had been portrayed in local newspapers as a young woman who betrayed her parents by becoming Catholic and, more than anything, not accepting her father's guidance. The media didn't like the idea of publishing reports of a woman like Ruth being so independent. Prosecutor Tate made the decision to not have Ruth testify in the case because she was so mistreated by the press that the prosecutor felt her testimony would hurt more than help the prosecution of her father. On October 21st of 1921, the jury deliberated for 4 hours and then acquitted Edwin Stevenson of the cold-blooded murder of Father John Coyle. No official transcript of the trial exists today. Maybe it was accidentally destroyed, or maybe it has something to do with most of the jury being members of the KKK, and an investigative report that later found the judge presiding over the case was also a member of the KKK. After the acquittal, Edwin Stevenson once again was a regular at the courthouse, conducting marriages until shortly before his death in 1956. Ruth and Pedro, well, their marriage fell apart before the trial was even over due to the heavy publicity. By 1923, they were divorced. Ruth left Birmingham and went to live in Chicago. She died there of tuberculosis in 1931. Pedro stayed in Birmingham. He did remarry, but years later, he was killed in a hit-and-run accident just steps away from where Father John Coyle had been murdered. Defense attorney Hugo Black joined the KKK in 1923, and 3 years after, he was elected to the U.S. Senate, where he served until he was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1937. At the time Franklin Delano Roosevelt appointed Black to the Supreme Court, it wasn't widely believed that FDR knew of the affiliation, but there was an exposé written about it before Black took his seat on the Supreme Court. There was a fight to try to keep him off the court, but he was seated and remained there for decades. Years later, Hugo Black renounced his Ku Klux Klan ties and became one of the most liberal members of the Supreme Court. He voted on the liberal side of many historic opinions, including the landmark case that desegregated American public schools in 1954. The assassination of Father Coyle did bring about some changes in the city of Birmingham. By 1941, Helen McGoy, a writer for the Catholic Weekly in Birmingham, wrote an article about Father Coyle and the effect his murder had on the city of Birmingham. She shared that his death was the climax of the anti-Catholic feeling in the city. After the trial, there followed such revulsion of feeling among the right-minded who before had been bogged down in blindness and indifference that slowly and almost unnoticeably, the Klan and their ilk began to lose favor among the people. On August 12th of 2012, over 90 years after the Methodist clergyman killed the Catholic priest in Birmingham, members of both churches gathered for a service to seek forgiveness and reconciliation between the churches and on behalf of the city. Birmingham writer John Wright Jr. has shared that he believes the life and assassination of Father Coyle and the not guilty verdict for Edwin Stevenson have relevance for Birmingham today because of the city's embarrassing history of unenlightenment and prejudice toward people who are different. And John Wright Jr. feels the story should leave us all asking ourselves one important question. What are you doing to discourage and curb prejudice wherever you work or worship or live or socialize? Father Coyle did all he could in his life to curb prejudice. He's buried at Elmwood Cemetery in Birmingham, and a 10-foot-high cross marks his resting place. There are plans underway to reinter his body near the Cathedral of St. Paul in downtown Birmingham, a fitting final resting place for this fearless truth-teller who was murdered for standing up for people of all faiths and of all walks of life. Father Coyle's own words speak to his willingness to sacrifice himself for others and for his faith. His closing handwritten entry in the pulpit announcements for what would be his final Mass on Sunday, August 7th of 1921, speak to his life's mission. He simply wrote, "Give, give till it hurts. Then and only then is there sacrifice." Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. If you'd like to learn more about Father Coyle and dig deeper into the story of his life and his death, read Sharon Davies' book, Rising Road, A True Tale of Love, Race, and Religion in America. You can also read some of Father Coyle's works and his letters by visiting the website for the Father James Edwin Coyle Society at fathercoyle.org. Coyle is spelled C-O-Y-L-E. Again, that's fathercoyle.org. I'll be sharing photos of Father Coyle and more information about the case in the Southern Mysteries podcast discussion group. Just search Southern Mysteries to join the group and be a part of the ongoing conversation about each case you hear on Southern Mysteries, and even share your own ideas for future episodes. You can also connect via Twitter. I'm at MysteriesPod. And make sure you subscribe to Southern Mysteries on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, any podcast player of your preference, so you make sure you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening.